From South Dakota to Louisiana, West Virginia to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, unemployment has hit a 50-year low. Middle-class take-home pay is up. The economy is surging. Here with a look at the new numbers and a peek at what lies ahead is John Tamney of FreedomWorks. Brett Kavanaugh is now an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, and his confirmation process has energized Republican voters ahead of the midterm elections. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth is here with the real story. The United Nations is out with yet another alarmist climate report. Eric Boehm and Ron Bailey of Reason Magazine explore possible policy responses to the report. And the hard-fought battle over the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh marked a new low in public discourse. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The economic good news continued with release of September's unemployment statistics, which found the nation's unemployment rate at its lowest level since the 1960s. Here to sort through the numbers is John Tamney. John is director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks. John, welcome back to American Radio Journal. John, the unemployment numbers are out for the month of September, and once again, it would appear that the economy has yielded a low number of unemployed, the lowest perhaps in decades. So tell us a little bit about that.
It's got to be remembered that economies are just people, and people naturally grow. They're naturally trying to better their situation. The only way they can't is if unnatural barriers are put in their place, usually of the tax, regulatory, trade, tariff, and unstable money variety. And so I think it's a fairly strong signal that while President Trump isn't perfect in terms of economic policy, in particular on the trade front, overall his policies have been rather benign and to some degree pro-growth. And with that, people in the economy just have naturally migrated to better and better jobs, and more people have come off the sidelines to get to work, and so it's a very positive sign.
In terms of the growing economy and job opportunities, are we seeing this just in certain groups of people, or is this extending across all economic classes and all demographic classes?
Everything that I've read has so far indicated that this is a very deep economic rally, as in it's hitting people of at all levels of the economic spectrum, from the high end of earnings to the low. You're hearing about smaller businesses and or service businesses that are really struggling to find good workers right now, just given the high demand for them. So it sounds like it's, as is always the case, a growing economy generally lifts all boats, and we're seeing that happen right here.
In terms of these job openings and what appears to be a growing lack of qualified employees, is this a factor that could possibly hold this economic expansion down going forward, the fact there aren't enough qualified workers out there now for the jobs available?
I don't think so. And my example is myself. I come from, I guess you'd call it Generation X, people who graduated in the late 80s throughout the 90s. Most of us didn't grow up with internet or anything related to the internet, but my generation adapted to work that is internet-based very quickly, and that same generation had a lot to do with the internet boom. And so my take is that, as is it's always the case, people can learn, they learn quickly what they need to learn in order to be employed, and what brings them into employment is that companies looking to add quality workers raise the amount that they're willing to pay, and that serves as a fairly potent lure. So I never worry about skills. People can develop skills very quickly.
You mentioned one of the areas where the president maybe is not as free market as other places is when it comes to trade. We have a new NAFTA agreement, and although I understand you don't have a crystal ball, what effect do you think having an agreement actually in place now will have on trade?
Well, it's good in the sense that it removes some uncertainty. Certainly the markets liked it. Probably what they would have liked a lot more is if President Trump hadn't done anything. Investors broadly liked NAFTA. And so the fact, but the good news here is that in bringing it back, Trump largely brought back what we had before. There's a bit more central planning to it, and that's unfortunate. There's lots of things like certain cars, if they're going to be made and sold in North America tariff-free, they have to have a certain amount of labor that costs at least $16 per hour. The inputs into the car have to, at a percentage of, I think, 75%, be made in North America. All of that's unfortunate. The Republican Party has historically been one about free markets and freedom for producers to do as they wish without meddling. There's a little bit of central planning in the new NAFTA, but largely it's the same as the one before, and investors broadly like that.
Let's talk for a minute or two now about the Federal Reserve. And John, many Americans, of course, have heard of the Federal Reserve. A lot of folks maybe don't quite understand how it operates and what impact it has. So just very briefly, what impact does the Federal Reserve actually have on our economy, and how does it try to manage it?
Well, I'm one of these people. I'm somewhat of an outlier here. I've long believed, and I wrote a book about it called Who Needs the Fed? I think the Fed's impact on the economy is vastly overstated. The Fed exists as a lender of last resort to solvent banks, but it can't really do that because no solvent bank would ever go to the Fed for a loan. It'd be an admission of bankruptcy. The Fed also regulates banks, but it can't really do that very effectively, as 2008 reminds us. And then, of course, it aims to set the overnight rate at which banks lend to one another, but an interest rate's a price like any other. You don't need the Fed for that. And so I think the Fed's impact is vastly overrated. People say, well, you know, they're going to reduce interest rates, and that's going to ease up credit. That's the equivalent of Mayor de Blasio saying in New York, oh, apartment rents are too high. I'm going to reduce how much landlords can charge for apartments. All he would do is just cause scarcity. In the same way, if markets actually responded to the Fed could at best cause scarcity by trying to artificially lower rates below what they would normally hit in the marketplace. So my point is we, in the real economy, we largely act as though the Fed doesn't exist. That's sort of an outlier position, but I believe it will be increasingly commonplace in the coming years.
The Fed has been on a rate increase, I won't say binge, because they've been doing it in small increments. This past week, it did seem to skitter the markets a little bit. Will the Fed raising the rates, will that cause the economy to cool off? Or, given your previous comments here, you don't think it's going to have much impact in the long run?
No, I don't think it will have much of an impact at all. Let's remember the Fed kept rates low at about zero, or the rate it aims to set, for years and years, from basically 2009 until, what, about 2015 or 2016. There was no major economic boom during that time. The Fed can't change reality. When we go to the market to borrow money, we're borrowing access to real resources, to trucks, tractors, computers, desks, chairs, most of all, human labor. The Fed can't expand the amount of that available. It can't make these resources cheap. And so I think the answer is to always remind ourselves the Fed is just another entity trying to influence things not very well.
We have been talking with John Tamney, who is the director of the Center for Economic Freedom at FreedomWorks. John, tell us a bit about FreedomWorks. Also, where can folks go on the web to get more information from you?
FreedomWorks is a wonderful organization based in Washington, D.C., that makes the essential point that Washington's not going to change unless politicians realize that the voters are changing, that they basically see what they're doing.
And your website is?
www.freedomworks.org.
John Tamney of FreedomWorks. John, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on what's been a fascinating last few weeks in the nation's capital, to say the least. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
Brett Kavanaugh is now an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, but the political ramifications likely are going to be felt for weeks as we head into the general election. Andy, is the Kavanaugh confirmation process, is this going to be an overall plus for Republicans?
Well, it is so far. I mean, obviously, we get a conservative justice that will help make the court a conservative majority that could last a very long time. And who knows, Trump may even get another pick before the end of his first term. But with regards to politics, there's evidence that Republican voter enthusiasm has picked up. You saw some recent polls that showed that the percentage of voters who think this election is very important used to be D plus 10, meaning Democrats are 10% more enthusiastic to vote than Republicans, and that has shrunk to D+2 since the Kavanaugh fight. So if Republicans show up at the polls with just as much enthusiasm as Democrats, then the Republicans will keep the House, and they will likely add to the Senate majority. So the Kavanaugh thing is a big deal. And let me point out that the Democrats want to politicize it, too. The Jerry Nadler, a House Democrat, he said that if the Democrats are in charge, he will be the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and he said his first thing will be to investigate Kavanaugh. And I assume the next thing they do is going to try and impeach Trump. So they're going to certainly keep Republican voters motivated to make sure that doesn't happen. So it's an odd thing when both parties agree to fight over the same issue.
Kavanaugh, of course, as you've mentioned here, is going to be a major issue heading into the election. Seems to be really energizing Republicans. Of course, the Democrats were, if you follow conventional wisdom, Andy, energized anyhow. So that they need Kavanaugh is probably a wash, a net plus for Republicans. But Andy, usually, as Jim Carville once famously said, it's the economy, stupid. So let's talk for a second. In our interview just prior to our discussion, we talked about the fact that unemployment is at the lowest ebb since the 1960s. The economy is surging. Shouldn't this be a net plus for Republicans?
Yes, it should. And I think it is. I think it is helping them. Like you said, unemployment is at a 50-year low. I mean, I think that's absolutely remarkable for those of us who have lived during the Reagan boom years and the Clinton boom years and the first part of the George Bush boom years. This is better than all of those. The unemployment rate's down to 3.7%, which is a remarkable statistic. And Trump is getting very little credit for that. Now, granted, Trump is getting in his own way with his tariffs. They are holding the economy back a little bit, and that's unfortunate. If he were able to get rid of those, I think the economy would soar even higher. And then one thing that isn't his fault is that the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, as they should, because rates have been artificially low for a decade since the financial crisis. So it's well past time that the rates start going up. The good news, though, is that you want to raise rates during an economy so that it doesn't get overheated and so that you can just have a steady climb upwards. So my hope is that that's exactly what we're experiencing now. In a few short weeks, people are going to vote with their pocket. I don't know if that will be the overwhelming thing that makes their decision, but when they know that they're getting a steady paycheck and things are looking good, voters tend to vote that way, and they support the people who helped make that happen.
The Democrat playbook, since the economy is going so well for Republicans, Andy, seems to be to try and put the focus back on health care. I personally live in a congressional district that's highly competitive. There are a lot of scare ads being put out by Democrats, and they seem to be wanting to focus on the whole issue of pre-existing conditions. Can you explain exactly where we stand on pre-existing conditions, and why are the Democrats making this such an issue?
This is a classic case. It'd be a good political science case study for college students, but the Democrat Party has always been considered the mommy party or the soft, gentler party. They want to protect people. They want to make sure that from cradle to grave that the government takes care for them in some way. And this includes people with pre-existing conditions, making sure that they get health insurance. Now, of course, the GOP is villainized, saying, oh, they want to keep sick people sick. But the truth is that pre-existing conditions does come with a cost. When you ask voters if people should be covered for pre-existing conditions, they overwhelmingly say yes. But then when you complete that sentence and you say, well, do you support people being covered for pre-existing conditions if you knew that everybody else has to pay higher premiums to pay for that coverage, then support collapses. Now, that's a difficult message for Republicans to communicate in 30-second TV ads versus Democrats, who can easily create a message in 30 seconds saying that Republicans are evil for not wanting people with pre-existing conditions to be covered by insurance. Now, Republican solutions to this, there are several, and they are very good ideas. It getting people covered with insurance who have pre-existing conditions. But the Democrat version is through just mere government force. The federal government, through Obamacare, will mandate that insurance companies cover pre-existing conditions. There is no other way for premiums to stay low if the government forces that mandate. It forces premiums to go high, which is why you see that happening with Obamacare.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, a couple of words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, again, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
The United Nations continues to beat the climate change drum and has come up with yet another report designed to back up its political views. Here to take a look at the report and what the U.S. response might be are Eric Boehm and Ron Bailey of Reason Magazine.
Earlier this week, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a new special report, a report that the UN Secretary General has described as an ear-splitting wake-up call to the world that confirms that we are running out of time. The report has set off another media frenzy surrounding global warming and climate change, mostly focused on just how bad things could get and how quickly. But what is undercovered is exactly what's in the report, the proposals that range from the unlikely to the economically devastating. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Ron Bailey. He's a friend of the show. I've had him on several times before. He's also a colleague of mine. He's the science correspondent for Reason Magazine, and he has spent the last several days digging through this new report. And he has a piece up at Reason.com right now. You can check it out. How big of a deal is an extra half degree of global warming? So we will ask him that question and some others here today. Ron, thanks for taking some time and being here on the show.
Delighted to be with you again.
Always glad to have you here, Ron, of course. And I should also mention that you are the author of the book, The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century. And that is appropriate, not just to plug your book here on the show, but that's appropriate because there's a lot of doom and gloom surrounding this new UN report, this new climate report that looks at just how quickly we are going to hit and surpass that supposedly crucial 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold. So tell us a little bit about what's in this UN report.
Well, the new report is called Global Warming of 1.5 Degrees Centigrade, and it was actually part of the process from the Paris Agreement on Climate Change, where the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, was invited or instructed to come up with scenarios of what would it be like or what would it take to keep the climate from warming by 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels of temperatures. And this report has just come out, and basically it says that there has to be a crash program embarked upon now costing at least $45 trillion between now and 2035, where we basically transform the economy from using fossil fuels to almost nothing but wind and solar power with energy efficiency on top of it. Otherwise, all kinds of dire, horrible consequences will follow.
What should we make, Ron, of this 1.5 degree Celsius threshold? How significant is that number? Is that actually a real tipping point, or is that something that activists have kind of latched onto to use as more of a political trigger here? Now, how serious do we take that number, and what sort of things have to be done, even just theoretically, to avoid surpassing that threshold?
Well, it would change it. The agreement under the Paris Climate Accords is basically the world should try to avoid going above 2 degrees centigrade. This is a much more draconian threshold. It's much slower. Just a little bit of background. The planet has warmed by about 0.9 degrees Celsius, that's in the report, since the late 19th century. And so they basically are trying to say we only have 0.6 degrees Celsius on average temperatures, for global average temperatures to go up before we reach this threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius. What they calculate is that we'd have to cut fossil fuel use by 2030 by 45% and be completely weaned off of all fossil fuels, oil, coal, natural gas, by 2050. That is a huge transformation, and no such energy transformation has ever taken place in the entire history of the world. They then try to come up with some pathways, as they call it, for how you might achieve that. And their takeaway message is that initially you'd have to at least start spending $2.4 trillion per year up until 2035 in order to even get close to doing this. That, to, just as a background, last year the International Energy Agency reported that for all energy investment for the year 2016 amounted to $1.7 trillion. And of that, it was just barely $300 billion in renewables. So what they're calling for is essentially scaling up expenditures on renewables by 10 times what we've been spending.
And look, if we could stop using dirty fossil fuels tomorrow with no negative consequences at all, right? If we could just shut them off and replace them all with green energy tomorrow, I think everybody would be fine with that. I don't think anybody is really committed to fossil fuels as a concept, right? But the reality is that there are serious economic consequences to making this transition because fossil fuels are cheaper and more plentiful than most of the alternatives that we have. We are talking with Ron Bailey. He's the science correspondent for Reason Magazine and the author of the book, The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century. Ron, just about a minute or so left here, but I'm just curious for your thoughts on, let's assume that man-made global warming is actually a real thing. What is the proper way to combat it in your mind?
Slow, gradual weaning away from fossil fuels over time. There are ways of doing it, and there are lots of pathways to do it. But the basic thing to do would be to figure out how to invest in research and development to come up with renewable energy sources that were in fact cheaper than fossil fuels. But one of the interesting things I found is that there is a scalable energy technology that could certainly contribute to what their goals are, and that is nuclear power, and they basically dismiss it. And I find that very puzzling because we know that's scalable, we know that it's technically feasible, and yet they just go, well, actually it's too complicated socially, we're not going to think about that. What instead we want to do is dot the landscape with solar panels and wind generation, windmills. What you really want to do is to create energy sources that can outcompete fossil fuels. If you do that, the problem solves itself.
Yeah, and of course, outcompete them without having to spend lots of subsidies and tax credits and all of that on those other forms. We are, unfortunately, we're not there yet. Ron Bailey from Reason Magazine, thanks so much for taking some time and being here today.
Delighted again to be with you.
And again, that is Ron Bailey. He's the science correspondent for Reason Magazine. You can check out his latest piece for us at Reason.com. How big of a deal is an extra half of degree of global warming? Find that again at Reason.com. Check out his book, The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century as well. You can find that on Amazon. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We will catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Civility was the biggest casualty of the recent Supreme Court confirmation hearings. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, says it's time for elected officials to begin acting more like statesmen.
In the past month, two extraordinarily different yet related events played out in the American landscape. One was a headline, whereas the other was just a footnote. The first event, the confirmation process for Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh, exploded in fury in the American media and in public discourse. The second event was the announcement of the awarding of the Medal of Honor to Sergeant Major John Canley for his heroism in Vietnam decades earlier. I was honored to receive an invitation to the Sergeant Major's award ceremony from my Sergeant Major, Eddie Neese. The Medal of Honor is bestowed on those individuals who, I quote, conspicuously by gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his or her life, above and beyond the call of duty, unquote, serve with selfless sacrifice and without regard to their own life. Virtually every American respects the Medal of Honor and the significant selfless sacrifice that the award conveys. It is this concept of selfless sacrifice, while revered, is missing so noticeably from our society today. I'm certain that our selfish preoccupation with instantaneous gratification have caused many of the problems we as a society face. Sergeant Major Canley fought valiantly in the battlefields of Vietnam and is finally being recognized for his selfless sacrifice and devotion to duty. His personal bravery serves as an example of what leadership is all about and reflects great credit upon himself, his unit, the United States Marine Corps, and the Naval Services. On the other hand, the confirmation process of Brett Kavanaugh was the epitome of some of the most disgraceful conduct ever exhibited by United States senators in the history of our nation. While Associate Justice Kavanaugh did not face bullets or imminent death, he was most certainly assaulted in the most offensive ways possible by those who are supposed to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. Those very senators knew all too well that the judge was not protected against defamation because of the case of the New York Times versus Sullivan. In other words, politicians and public figures have little recourse to slanderous conduct unless actual malice is proven. It is an almost impossible standard to prove, which means that the judge, by accepting the nomination to the court, had to be willing to subject himself and his family to horrific conduct by those opposed to his views. If a nation is ever going to attempt to rebuild itself, the very character of the nation must emphasize selflessness, a moral code of decency, and personal responsibility. Our national character, as represented by great heroes like Sergeant Major Kenley, is under assault. This battle is more than just the battle for a Supreme Court nomination. It is about the very struggle for survival of the freedoms that we espouse in the Bill of Rights and for which Sergeant Major Kenley and millions of others fought. All of us in the military and in government take the same oath of office to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. The conduct of the senators attacking Kavanaugh on hearsay and innuendo for political gain was disgraceful. Those senators victimized Justice Kavanaugh, Dr. Ford, and all of us for political gain. In a different type of battle, equally as important to win, Justice Kavanaugh fought to protect the very fabric of the Constitution he has sworn to defend. By not backing down, he convinced me of his moral courage in the face of unwavering criticism. One of the primary underpinnings in any civilized society is the presumption of innocence. This nonsense that the presumption of innocence did not apply because it was a job interview is a travesty. It is a travesty inflicted by the opposing side upon the very character of a person and our nation. It was a sad day for our entire nation and those of us who fought to defend this nation and our Constitution, your Bill of Rights, and common law. The sheer duplicity of their arguments fell on deaf ears of those of us who had to defend while in the military the character of our nation and our people. Elected leaders, of which I am now one, have a responsibility to be statesmen first and politicians second. The travesty of the conduct of those opposing Kavanaugh's nomination to the Supreme Court cast shame and dishonor on the institution in which they were elected to serve. Fortunately, others in the Senate stood firm and upheld the societal framework of the presumption of innocence. Those brave senators withstood tremendous pressure to conform the very precepts of the Constitution that they had been sworn to uphold. When a nation sends its citizens into combat and into the military, it has a moral responsibility to support and defend that same Constitution. The military supports it in harm's way, whereas elected leaders are obligated to support the Constitution in the halls of Congress. Both arenas are critical if our nation is to survive. Only through our emphasis on selfless sacrifice, moral courage, and a personal accountability will our nation survive. Our founding fathers left us a wonderful legacy. What we do with that legacy is our decision and ours alone. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WRFH-FM in Hillsdale, Michigan, WKHJ-FM in Mountain Lake, Maryland, along with WQTQ-FM in Oakland, Maryland. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.